The shooting at the University of California, Santa Barbara, has raised questions, again, about mental health, violence against women, and gun control. But will this attack lead to reforms in the health system or gun laws? And the scandals continue over mismanagement at the Veterans Administration. Now that VA Secretary Eric Shinseki has resigned, what will it take to fix the problems? What are the challenges facing Nevada veterans? Some folks are trying to focus Congress's attention back on immigration, but will House Republicans bother with the big Senate bill before the next presidential election? And this is, by the way, an election year. But where are the lines? Why is there such apathy about who leads our political institutions? What should we do to build a bigger sense of civic obligation? Joining us now to discuss those issues and many others is Sarah Feldberg. She's the editor of the Las Vegas Weekly. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
And so what is it that's on your mind? What are you thinking about today?
Well, one of the things that I'm thinking about is the upcoming World Cup and the proposals recently for a couple of stadiums in Las Vegas that would be bidding for a Major League Soccer expansion team. And the more I think about it, the more I like the idea of having Major League Soccer in Las Vegas. We've been really wanting a professional sports team for a long time here, and I think soccer might be a good fit for this community.
But how many times have we got to the point where people say, yes, here's the promise, but then nothing?
Absolutely. I mean, we've been through this before, and we are not the only ones competing for this team. We're going up against places like Austin, Texas, and Minneapolis, and San Diego, which some people might think have a better shot at really supporting a team. But I think this would be a good fit for Las Vegas. We have a community that's come out for some soccer games before when we've had some friendly matches here in the recent past. We have a large Hispanic community where soccer has been a big part of the culture for years and years and years. And we have a community that's very transient, and I don't think people have the same kind of loyalties to Major League Soccer that they would do to a team from, you know, a football team from home or a baseball team from home where their family's been rooting for the same team for generations and generations.
So would you be willing to put your money where your mouth is? I mean, should we actually go spend public dollars to build this stadium to try and lock the team in?
Well, I mean, that is a really hard question. And I think when it comes to public dollars, there are a lot of needs in this community, and probably a professional sports team is not the biggest one. But as far as a fit for, say, the Symphony Park area where downtown and the city of Las Vegas is trying to put the stadium, that area could really use another driver. It could use another attraction, a draw next to the World Market Center and the Smith Center. And maybe a stadium project that would host a Major League Soccer team would really help to revitalize that area.
And also joining us in the studio is Jose Melendres. He's Assistant Vice President of Diversity Initiatives at UNLV. Jose, it's great to have you back in the studio.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
And so what is it that's on your mind?
Well, I think a professional soccer team would be nice. I think any kind of professional team would be nice in Las Vegas. I think the city is growing, and the maturity of what's happening in terms of, like, with the Smith Center, the success and some of the things that are going on out at UNLV for the push out there for a stadium. I think there's a lot of different ways that this community could come together and promote something like that that would bring a professional team with the high caliber of stadium and that could move our community forward when it comes to having that kind of programming and community building opportunities that a professional sport team would bring. I wanted to comment. There is a minor league team here now, the Las Vegas Mobsters, that are playing out at UNLV. And so I think there's a large community here that are big time soccer fans. And so to have something like that, that would build on that, you know, with the minor league divisions and then going on to the professional division would be great for the city. But in my world of what I do, one of the things that I've been looking at or working with late the last several weeks is the White House initiative on my brother's keeper that came out, an initiative to get more young and black and Latino males on the right pathways, resources to create opportunities for them, both in education and working, and so to create a positive environment for those kids, for those young people who are, when you see what's happening with the incarceration of young black and Latino males versus those who are going to college. So that's something that's just been kicked off. There was a big meeting that was held, sponsored by Congressman Stephen Horsford, at one of the public schools in West Las Vegas. And it was a great opportunity to see a coalition of black and Latino and a lot of different folks who were there to support Pat Skorkowski from the school district. So a lot of folks coming together behind this to move this initiative forward. So that's something I've been
involved. Don't we really need to get down to the community, the people who this is aimed at?
Well, you said, you know, you said in your opening comments about community engagement. That's huge. You know, creating these types of programs and these types of opportunities for these young people when it comes to jobs, when it comes to opportunities for education, when it comes to access and services, when it comes to quality of life issues, it's these types of initiatives that are going to need to happen. You know, you have longstanding programs like Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and community-based initiatives with several different nonprofits, Boys and Girls Club. You have those types of initiatives, but we're a growing community, you know, and now that we're starting, now that I think that the economy has taken that turn and we are starting to rebound a little bit, we need those types of opportunities. We need to create real opportunities for these young people so that they can see a pathway to success. You know, you often, at least in my world of higher education and doing community engagement work, you often hear about what the prison industry does, and the prison industry will come in, they'll look at our third grade reading scores, and they'll know over the next decade how many beds they're going to need to have in the prisons because they're going to be filled up. So it's the same conversation that we're having now in higher education when it comes to working with the school districts and K-12 and all that is, can we look at those same third grade reading scores and say, okay, these are the kids that are on the right pathway. They're still going to need resources and support. But then here are the kids who aren't on that right pathway. What do we need to do? What kind of intervention do they need so that we can get them on that right pathway? And so it's creating pathways from cradle to career versus cradle to prison.
So what are the problems, though? What are the things that are stopping those programs succeeding?
Obviously, financial resources. You know, when you look at, there's been several studies that have been done here in Nevada about the need for creating more of a culture of volunteerism, a culture of supporting nonprofits. When you look at other big-time cities in terms of what they have a strong network foundation for nonprofits who do this kind of work. We have a handful of nonprofits. I think we're growing. They're getting bigger and more community-based type, smaller groups. But the challenges are there in terms of fundraising and how do you raise those kinds of dollars that you need to sustain programs, to have programs that are going to have real impact. And that's a constant challenge. You know, part of what we do out at UNLV is we work with a lot of those nonprofits. You've got the Downtown Center now. Our School of Urban Affairs has a huge program where they train folks in nonprofit leadership to really promote that. We know that's a segment in our community that if we're going to grow and we're going to be competitive with other big cities, you need to have a strong nonprofit sector that can come in and do that kind of work, because your local government agency, they might have elements and components of that, but it's really those nonprofits who take it home and get into those communities to really engage and provide those services and engage folks. And I think that's a big part of when you talk about community engagement and civic engagement, that's a big part of what we really need to continue developing. I think we're growing in Southern Nevada in those areas, but we still have a lot of work to do.
So what about that community engagement? Are you interested in building a soccer stadium to attract a team here to Las Vegas? We're interested in what's on your mind this morning. What do you think about these issues or any other issue? Jose, just for a second here on those opportunities, you call them opportunities, but what about peer pressure problems? I mean, isn't it part of the problem that the guys this is targeted on are often going to think these programs, these opportunities are uncool, are going to not want to make that leap?
You know, my experience has been one of my first positions here in Southern Nevada when I first got out of college was to work for the Boy Scouts of America, and I was in what was a program called to Urban Emphasis Scouting. So it was taking those kids who were in high at-risk schools and bringing them into scouting. And I'm talking about we were going into schools where they hadn't seen scouting programs in 10 years. And so it was really about offering these kids an alternative. And so something that I've come to learn professionally is that if there isn't a positive alternative for these kids to get involved with, then they're going to get involved with what exists. And if that's your local street gang, if that's your local drug dealer, whatever's out there that's going to attract, that's going to recruit them and try to bring them into that negative way of life, it's going to happen. So you need to put these services in place. We need to have these programs. So I know like Clark County and City of Las Vegas have a strong Parks and Recs program, and I know they do a lot of gang outreach and a lot of intervention work. But when budgets are being cut and when resources are being limited, then maybe you don't have enough staff to reach out to all the kids. You know, and when you're talking about the fifth largest school district with the growth that we've experienced in Southern Nevada, those are obviously challenges. And that's where a nonprofit who has resources, who understands that work, can really come in and add another element of intervention, of outreach and engagement.
So there you have it. Soccer programs, social programs, all require public money. Are you willing to put that money in? The number again, 702-258-3552, 702-258-3552. Let me turn now to another issue that's been in the news a lot. The shooting tragedy at UC Santa Barbara about 10 days ago has spurred a lot of discussion about gun control and violence against women. The shootings and stabbings also raised questions about mental health and misogyny. Here's a sample of that YouTube video that the shooter, Elliot Rogers, left behind.
Hi, Elliot Roger here. Well, this is my last video. It all has to come to this. Tomorrow is the day of retribution. The day in which I will have my revenge against humanity. Against all of you.
That was the YouTube video created by Elliot Roger before the shootings in Santa Barbara. And Sarah Feldberg, what was your reaction when you first heard about that the Friday night before last?
Well, obviously, it's a tragedy, and it's horrible to hear about something like this happening and something like this happening again. I think, to me, that's the really hard part of this, is that we don't seem to be able to prevent it. We're not keeping guns out of the hands of people with mental health problems. We're not addressing the mental health problems in a way to help these people and keep them from getting in this situation in the first place. But one of the things that really stuck out to me about this case was the element of misogyny in it, and the fact that there had been so many warning signs from this very troubled young man who had been receiving treatment since I think he was 8 years old. This was not somebody whose problems were well masked. He was a very public threat. And, you know, police officials, sheriff's officials had actually visited him a couple of weeks before the shooting occurred, had spoken with him, and had left without being able to search the premises. And he had written, I think, in his manifesto document that they would have found his plan and his weapons had they entered his home. And I think for me, one of the really troubling things is, as a woman in media, you know, we get comments from people all the time saying pretty horrible things to women who write for us or the women that we write about at Las Vegas Weekly magazine. And I think our policy has generally been, for a lot of women in media, you know, don't feed the trolls. Don't give them the satisfaction, ignore them, you know, don't respond, be above the fray. And in this case, we have a very troubled young man who was posting these kind of comments, who was expressing these kinds of hatred, this kind of violent point of view towards women. And I think so many people did ignore it as just the online ravings of a guy who was troubled and needed help and needed
But what's the link there between the crazy guy and the trolls and the misogyny that you see from day to day? I mean, is there a link?
I think part of the link is learning as a culture, when do we need to really address this? When is ignoring it and saying we're not going to stoop to that level actually putting people in harm's way?
Well, what about the ignoring it? I mean, you yourself said how much his parents had tried. He'd been in and out of mental health treatments. I mean, we always say, let's just fix the mental health system. Well, this guy was right in the thick of the mental health system and nothing happened to catch him.
He was in the thick of the mental health system for a time, although to my knowledge, he hadn't actually been treated since leaving for college. He had sort of slipped out of that system. He had been, you know, in very specialized high schools. He had, I think, attended three different high schools, but he had then left home. He had left that system of support and of monitoring, had gone away to a college where he was living with roommates, where he maybe did not have the support and the attention that he needed from mental health officials, and he slipped through.
Well, but isn't the slipping through often when we don't want to get too close? We think, well, he looks all right. I mean, that's what those cops thought, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, they went to his home. They spoke to him. They said he was timid and shy and polite. And he was the kind of person who was very good at functioning well in public. He could, you know, talk to these police officers and give them a sense of calm. So they left. And that's really dangerous. You know, we need to be taking this kind of thing very seriously. And, you know, we need to be monitoring these people, especially when they're online and they're giving hints about these kind of plans, and that we can't ignore it as a community.
But, well, hints, though, I mean, look at that, you know, 99%, what is it, 99.9% of the people who put misogynistic stuff on the internet aren't going to act on it. I mean, where's the line here between free speech and misogyny?
I think that's something we're still figuring out. I mean, it is still a new forum for us. The internet as a place of hate speech, as a place of violence, and a place of anger. This is something we're still all learning. And I think with this person, it had gotten to the point where people on some of his forums said, hey guys, do you think it's time to tip off the police? I've never actually seen that in a comments feed before, and the fact that it had gotten there, where anonymous strangers acting online really started to recognize that this person was intending to do something, and that he, you know, was speaking not just venting his frustrations, but was actually speaking from a place of violence and anger. We need to prepare people, and we need to teach people how to recognize those signals and what to do when they see them.
So what do you think about that? Can we teach people to recognize those signals? Can we draw this distinction between free speech, misogyny, and the danger to women, the attack on women? The number, of course, 702-258-3552. That's 702-258-3552. Or you can post your comments online at knprnews.org. The shooting, of course, as we've mentioned already, it did raise questions about misogyny and entitlement. And in fact, the video explicitly draws this out. And I want to play a little bit of that, more of that video that was left on YouTube by Elliot Roger.
College is the time when everyone experiences those things such as sex and fun and pleasure. But in those years, I've had to rot in loneliness. It's not fair. You girls have never been attracted to me. I don't know why you girls aren't attracted to me, but I will punish you all for it.
That, of course, was from the YouTube video left by Elliot Roger before the shooting last week. I want to ask you, Jose Melendre, I mean, a lot of the commentators have looked at this and said this really represents the entitlement attitude of young white men in America. They point to the connections between that girl that was stabbed in a Connecticut high school when she refused to go to the prom with a boy. And they say there's this continuity that young white men just expect women to be available. How do you feel about that?
Oh, wow. You know, that's a tough one to comment on in terms of entitlement. Obviously, you see places of privilege. You see places of where these the sense of right and wrong is really skewed in terms of behavior towards one another, towards each other, how we treat our fellow human being. And I think you see some of that happening. Obviously, you see it happening in regards to when something like this happens and being the tragedy that it is of where were the signs missed, who was speaking to this individual that didn't catch that and if we're not trained in that. And so that sense of entitlement that if something doesn't go my way, then I'm going to take lethal action because I didn't get what I wanted. It's hard to say. I mean, it's hard. How do you respond to something like that and talk to, you know, I think if you talk to the parents, they felt they were doing everything they could to make sure their son was having the types of services that he needed, the type of treatment that he needed, goes off to college or goes off on his own. And it's the first time that some of these kids are on their own and what that means to, be in, adult responsibilities and relationships and the types of things of behavior that's expected or that you assume and that where that was missed. You know, I know when I look at my personal experience as a parent, I have a daughter who's 9 and a son who's 6. And all I can think about is that am I doing everything? Am I giving them the foundation that they're going to need to be successful adults someday at whatever they do? And so I think that's a challenge at all, not only as parents, but as a community. Are we doing the right things that we need to do for these kids in terms of what they're learning in school and how they interact, how they treat their fellow human being? These are all questions that need to be addressed. And it goes back, I take it again, and I'll put on my social worker hat because my training is in social work. And so it goes back to what we do as a community, how we get involved, the types of services and programs that are put in place. You're addressing an issue, the fact again that somebody had access to weapons and guns and I know that's a whole other conversation, but the issue that I think was said at best was the father who lost a child in this tragedy. When he spoke at the memorial service, that he blamed all the politicians because they've not done anything. You've had all these shootings that have happened over the last 4 or 5 years, 6 years, and they've still not done anything to address the gun laws. You know, and so I believe he used the word cowards with all of the politicians because they've not addressed the gun laws. And, you know, and I know that is a very touchy situation, but, you know, you look at other countries where even law enforcement, unless it's some kind of radical situation, they don't carry guns. You know, and here in the United States, I think we lose more people are victims of gun violence in the United States than any of the wars that we're fighting, you know? And so that's it's something that is way out of control in the United States. And it goes back to, you know, when you deal with the mental health issues, when you deal, what you talked about, the sense of entitlement that maybe some of these young people are feeling, things don't go the way that they can take this kind of retribution and payback on folks. What is going on with our society, and where are we missing it to address those issues?
Sarah Feldberg, the White House, of course, has been talking about trying to get new initiatives to cut down on sexual violence on campuses. I mean, is this part of the same story here, that with Elliot Rodge, the sense of entitlement?
You know, I think it is part of the same story, obviously to a much more extreme degree in the case of Elliot Rodger, but I think it is part of the same story. The issue of entitlement, whether men feel, and especially young men feel, that women don't really have a right to say no, that the word no is the start of a negotiation instead of a declaration of intent. My own university that I attended, Tufts University, has been in the spotlight recently for its treatment of some victims of sexual abuse on campus. And it's really disturbing to hear, I think, for people in the higher education system, teaching both female students and male students how to approach this, how to intervene in many cases when they see something like this happening, and really that it's everyone's responsibility to prevent this from happening, that it's not, you know, because a girl gets drunk at a party, that isn't an invitation for a guy next door to take advantage of her, and that it's really the responsibility of the entire campus community to look at that girl and say, okay, we need to protect her. She's in a vulnerable state, not to punish her for getting into that state in the first place.
So did you see that? Did you experience that when you were in college, this sense that, I mean, the way you put it, I think, was that no is the beginning of a negotiation?
Yeah, actually, thinking way back now to my college orientation, we had a program during orientation that was titled No Means No. And at the time, it was the subject of a lot of joking. I think, you know, everyone's 18 years old and they're so excited to be on campus. And they all kind of go, yeah, of course, no means no. Ha, ha, ha. But I think kind of as college goes on, you realize that that actually is a really serious issue. And it's the most straightforward way to put it. And that kids are going to experience that themselves, whether it's a friend or a roommate or themselves, they're going to experience that. And kids are, you know, they're experimenting in college. They're in a state where they are putting themselves into vulnerable positions, whether it's through the use of alcohol, whether it's just meeting people on a campus environment where they may feel safer than they actually are. So I think really kind of emphasizing that we all need to be protecting each other in these situations, and that it is our responsibility. You know, if we see a woman in a position where she's being victimized or where she's being targeted in a way that's inappropriate, that, you know, as a bystander, you have every right and every responsibility to step in and say, hey, you know, she said no to you, and that should be the end of this discussion.
But who's going to be that brave person that stands up against a crowd? I mean, if it looks, you know, do you really want to be the person that does that?
I mean, I don't think anyone wants to, but I think it's emphasizing that we need to. And I think it only takes a few people to learn to do that, and suddenly it becomes the normative thing to do. And it's not an issue of being the bravest one in the room. It's really an issue of expectation that we do protect each other.
Jose Melendez? Yeah,
no, you know, I think, and you're right. I think, I think everybody comes, whatever your experiences have been, you have that sense of right and wrong, you know. And so then I think, and you know, working at the university, I know that we have multiple programs in place through student affairs, through advising, through the Center for Mental Health, where somebody can go, and if they're feeling a certain way, they can go and talk to somebody, a trained psychologist, the health clinic on campus. So there's a lot of venues in place where we're doing programming, where we're doing educational awareness development, and building that sense of understanding of what's right and what's wrong. And I think we all have a responsibility, not only at the university, but then as a community, in terms of addressing those issues, so that when somebody does come, they understand that sense of right and wrong.
I mean, you're talking now as an administrator, but yeah. Talk about when you were a student. I mean, did you and your friends think that the college was just a party, and that party meant that women should join in the party?
I don't think that I've ever thought that. I think that everybody, I mean, if I go back as a college student, yeah, everybody.
What about
has,
your friends, though?
Right, everybody. You know, I always say the people that you surround yourself with are hopefully an element of who you are. And I know I have this conversation with young people all the time. You really need to think about it when you're going through school, and especially when you get into high school and you get into college. You have to think carefully about who your friends are going to be, because it's going to be those friends that are going to get you into trouble. And so you have to think about the people. And again, it comes down to those decisions that we make of right and wrong, of who we, do we surround ourselves with positive peers, or do we get involved with the kids who you know are causing trouble and they're going to get you into more trouble.
So there were male peers who were causing trouble who sort of did have this.
Oh, sure, there are. I'm sure there are. You know, I know. And I'm
so
sure.
So where did that come from? What made them think that way?
Whatever's happened in their background, whatever's happened in their development of what that they would think that they could treat a woman a certain way. I know that I was always trained to and educated to respect, to be kind, to treat people the way that I want to be treated, or how I would expect to be treated. You know, and does that always play out? Obviously, it doesn't. But I think when you get to a college, especially when in a college environment, a lot of time this is the first time that they have all kinds of freedom. Mom and dad isn't around to tell them what to do. They're being pushed into becoming adults. Now, are they all ready? Obviously, they're not all ready to accept the responsibility of that. And that's where the institution comes in with programs and services and things that they can do to raise the awareness. But it's like you say, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't force it to drink, right?
Yeah, but sure. But I mean, 1 o'clock in the morning on a Friday night, the services isn't always going to be there. But I mean, don't we rely, like Sarah says, on people being able to stand up?
No, but those services are there during the times when you offer them. It's still that, you know, it still falls on that young person to okay, I'm going to go to this program, I'm going to go to this workshop, I'm going to go listen to this story of what happened. I think what the White House did was to push it and put it in a very public venue. I mean, they went as far as naming institutions publicly about, well, we're looking into the practices on those campuses, you know. So they put this out in the public, which I think from my perspective, an administrator at the university, my hat's off to them, because it did, I think it forced all of us to say, okay, what are our policies? What are we doing enough to support our students and make sure that they have everything they need, so that when that 1 o'clock morning decision comes, that they're hopefully going to do the right thing and not the wrong thing.
So we're asking this morning, what's on your mind? Is it the issues about mental health, guns, male entitlement? Is it building community here in Las Vegas? Are you interested in other questions? By all means, we're open to anything you want to talk about this morning, because it's what's on your mind. The number to call, of course, 702-258-3552. That's 702-258-3552. And we've got Alex on the line. Alex, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hello. Morning.
So what's on your mind?
Well, you know, I've been listening to, you know, the issues after the shooting in Santa Barbara, and I raised three girls, one of which was accosted in college when she was in college. And back then, this was several years ago, back then we seemed to turn our attention to taking away funding from student counselors, adults that we put in the education system to help guide these young emerging minds. We removed those funds. And we posted those towards fighting wars in other nations. We cut our social services. And then we're all standing around surprised that we've got young 18-year-olds with raging hormones running amok.
So, Alex, tell us what exactly did happen to your daughter.
She was mugged, with attempted rape on the way back from class at 6 o'clock in the evening. And I'll leave the university out. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
The big problem there, when I confronted the campus police and we went through the whole process, I mean, this is a child that wasn't drinking. She wasn't coming back from a club. She was just coming back from a late study session. And she was mugged on her way back to her dormitory. So it all boils down to when I sat down with the campus police, their response back to me was, we just don't have the funds for the offices. The money is not there. Our priorities as a society is not ensuring that we have well-balanced, educated children coming out. Our problem as a society in general is we're totally focused on what is happening elsewhere and not what is going on right under our noses. And every year, every month that we have a shooting, a child gone wild, is because the social services that we used to have are no longer available.
But what kind of social services would we have that would actually be able to prevent these crimes?
Well, you have a venue. This is a child that was obviously reaching out for something. he was reaching out to anybody and everybody that would listen. But there wasn't a counseling session. When my daughters were in college, when my first daughter went, I think it was like 25 or 35 to 1. By the time my second and third daughter went to college, it was 50, 100 kids to one counselor. When could this person possibly, or how could this person possibly dedicate any quality time to a troubled individual? I mean, we're talking about an individual that is not only responsible for guiding this person through their educational process, but is also a sort of mentor, a replacement for the parent. But we have diminished the number of valuable people that we used to have there. And it used to be, in the old days, it used to be our old senior citizens that were mature adults that we would give a part-time, a well-rewarding career to work in the university, be nothing more than a counselor. But those have all been pushed away because our funding is more important to do other things. It's very infuriating.
And when you say we had that huge counseling ratio that the adults were working to keep the place safe, are you talking about when you were in college, or how far back are we talking?
When I was in college back in the 70s, it was a higher ratio. It started to diminish in the 80s. By the time my kids went to school in the 90s or to college in the 90s, it was a shell of what the program used to be.
Thank you very much, Alex. That's very interesting. So, Sarah, can counseling prevent this? Is that a necessary part of what we should be doing?
You know, it's hard to say what preventative measures can really be taken, whether it's on the mental health side or on the gun control side and keeping weapons out of the hands of troubled individuals in the first place. But I think counseling certainly helps. And it helps both for an adult to recognize that this person is having trouble adjusting to campus life, that he is angry at a lot of people around him. It helps if his roommates have someone to talk to and they say, hey, you know, our roommate seems to be having a lot of problems. We're really worried about him. It helps some of the women who he had sort of yelled at or targeted in kind of less aggressive ways, but throwing his coffee on girls at a bus stop or, you know, hitting couples on a field with a super soaker filled with orange juice. If those people have trusted adults who they can go to and say, hey, this kid's a little off, we're worried about something, maybe we do get to prevent this. Maybe we get to at least take a closer look and have the chance to really connect with someone and make sure that they aren't going to do violence to anyone around them or themselves.
So, Jose Melendez, I mean, you work at UNLV.
Yeah, I was just thinking about what the caller was saying. And, you know, it's a matter of it's all of the above. And so when you're responsible for those types of programs and services and actions and things that need to be happening, then I think it's a great point. Are we putting of the resources that we do have available to us, are we putting those resources in the right place to train more counselors, to train more, to have more intervention programs, to have more services available to families and kids so that everybody can be – because, you know, I think it takes a community to be involved and to help build positive environment for our young people. And if you can't do that or there's an element missing then who's losing out? It's those kids. It's those young people who are going to pay the ultimate price for this, whether they're a victim or whether the person, even the person who causes it, is a victim, because what's going to happen to them? And so that situation exists. And so how do we as a community, as a city, as a society, how do we put the resources that we do have and make sure that they're being put in the right places to provide those types of positive environments for our kids, for our young people, and to support families? I mean, you have a huge issue in Southern Nevada with how do we engage parents in the process, you know, and I say that from the perspective both at UNLV and in the school district. We have the fifth largest school district, and parental engagement, and it's the success of parental engagement is really dependent upon the principal at each individual school. There is one office, one individual that staffs that office. So there's a resource that I don't think we fully utilize in terms of how we can engage parents in the process of being partners with us to address some of these issues.
This morning on KNPR State of Nevada, we're asking, of course, what's on your mind? Our guest, Sarah Feldberg, is editor of the Las Vegas Weekly, and Jose Melendez is assistant vice president for diversity initiatives at UNLV. Another issue that is in the news right now, of course, is the administration's plans for cutting carbon. President Obama's EPA has raised the issue with new standards announced yesterday that states will have to meet for all power plants. And here's a little of what EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy said yesterday.
We are directed by our laws and it is reaffirmed by the courts that we are here to protect public health and the environment. And today, climate change that's fueled by carbon pollution is supercharging risks, not just to our health, but to our communities, to our economy, and to our way of life. That's why EPA is delivering on a vital piece of President Obama's climate action plan.
And that, of course, was EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy announcing plans to have states cut back on coal-fired power plants and other carbon pollution in the production of electricity. What's this going to mean for Nevada? Do we need this kind of a plan in Nevada, Sarah Feldberg?
I mean, I think we need this kind of a plan everywhere. I think, you know, every week, every month, there's a new report out, a new study by scientists around the world just emphasizing the effects of climate change and how quickly they're coming. We're seeing sea levels rise all across the world. We're seeing coastal communities in jeopardy, flooding issues. It's not getting any better right now. And I don't think we've seen the private sector leading the way on this. They're not innovating. They're not cutting carbon emissions the way that we need them to. So maybe it's time that we make some real demands and change things.
But we've got years of court cases, lots of political opposition. There's already people saying in the Senate they're going to try and cut this back. Then, of course, it's just a fairly long-term plan. It's going to take, 10, 15 years to fully implement it. And then it's only a 30% cut. Is that enough?
I mean, it's something. I don't know if it's enough. I haven't, I am not a climate change expert by any means. But climate change is a long-term thing. This is not something it's not something at this point that we can address in a year or two or 10. This is something that's ongoing. It's not getting any better. It's only getting worse. And it's something that's going to affect the entire future of the planet. So I think long-term is not really an issue here. As long as it's going to take, the planet's here, we're here, we need to address it however we can.
So what if it puts a lot of people out of work? I mean, what if it really does create problems for the economy?
That is an issue, and I think it needs to be addressed. But in cutting emissions and changing the way we get our energy sources, we're going to need to get creative. We're going to need to turn to alternative energy sources and create new jobs and create new opportunities in those sectors that maybe don't exist yet. Whether it's going to be a one-to-one match, I can't say. But I think those jobs aren't necessarily going to be lost altogether. Maybe they're going to be moved to a different element.
So, we know Jose Melendres, UNLV's working on these.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of research right now that points to the fact that the jobs of the future have not even been created yet. That we don't know what that's going to look like. And I think as the United States as a country and our government and with all the research and all the smart folks that we have working in our country, I think if by doing the right thing for this planet, because it's we don't have another option, right? And so if that means that, yes, certain jobs are going to be eliminated, then let's put that people power, that brain power into, okay, so in eliminating those jobs, what jobs need to be created? And I think there's another, again, it's where we put our resources in. I mean, there was another scientist who was being interviewed a couple of weeks back on public radio, and he was talking about, look, folks, the reality is that the climate change, it's happened. It's here. We're living with it right now. You looked at what happened this past winter with 26 different incidents of some kind of crazy winter storms that hit. This guy was saying it's happened. It's here. We're living with it right now. And so really get thinking about, and the United States is all, I think we're always going to have to be in the lead of this, of that, okay, if certain jobs are eliminated because we have to do right by the environment, then what other jobs need to be created? And they're out there. They can be created. I mean, we talk about it. You look at what's happening at UNLV right now. We're putting a lot of priorities into what's happening with STEM. We know that there are a lot of opportunities in Nevada because our environment is just right for all kinds of different opportunities in the STEM fields. And so how are we training our workforce? What are we putting in place for our young people to think about, hey, if you choose to become an engineer in this area, if you choose to become solar power, wind power, all these different things that there are new opportunities for, those jobs haven't been created yet. So how are we preparing as our workforce, as an economy, as a community to be prepared for that and think about where we want to be 10 years, 15 years, 20 years down the road? Because, again, we're living with it right now. What kind of planet are we going to turn over to our kids?
Right. But, you're saying we, meaning we here in Nevada, we here in the United States. But you look at Brazil, they're still chopping down the rainforest. The Chinese still want to use coal. We're not even the biggest polluter anymore.
But I guess we're not. But we have, we do still have a lot of influence, or at least I like to think we have influence. I'm an optimist, so I'm always preaching. I'm always hoping for that we're going to do the right thing by the environment, by the planet, by our young people. And it is, I say we, because it is all of our responsibility, whether we agree with it or not. We all have a responsibility to create a better planet. And I'm not an environmentalist, but I hear my brothers and sisters who are environmentalists and what they go through and the struggles that they go through. And it's all of us. It's all of us. Whether I do my part with recycling and what I do with my house and what I can't control, we all have a part in it. We all have a responsibility in it. And I know some people disagree, but, you know, what's the alternative? You know, you watch those doom films about what the future looks like, and wow, that is scary.
The number, of course, is 702-258-3552. That's 702-258-3552. And this morning we're asking, what's on your mind? What are the issues that are troubling you? Are you concerned about this new plan that will cut back on the use of coal in creating electricity? Is it something that the United States has to take the lead on? Or is it something that we should try and get other people to work towards first before we take the tough measures? The number, of course, 702-258-3552. One other issue, of course, or maybe it's the non-issue right now in Nevada, is the primary election. We're supposed to be having an election. Occasionally, you might see signs outside of a grocery store for early voting. But there just doesn't seem to be much enthusiasm. Why are we so unenthusiastic about these primary elections, Sarah?
That's a great question. They are midterm elections, and they're never sexy. People, I think, are generally fairly apathetic when there isn't, you know, a presidential candidate in the running and a reason to really get involved for a lot of people. And I think right now in Southern Nevada, maybe the races are not super exciting for people. They haven't been following the races or the campaigns in a dramatic way, and we're just not seeing the level of interest and response.
But this is politics. We should be interested in this because we're citizens. This isn't like, oh, I really want to get excited about a movie on Friday night.
We should be interested. Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree more. These people, they affect our lives. They affect our future. They affect our community. They affect everything. So certainly the Nevada and Southern Nevada community should be following this, should be engaged. But we have not found a way to reach them, I think, as far as keeping them interested in politics and really emphasizing how important it is that they exercise their right to vote, or we maybe shouldn't be complaining later on about what the politicians are doing.
So, Jose Melendez, you got any thoughts on how we can beef this up?
You know, it goes back to your comments earlier about civic engagement. We all have a responsibility to pay attention to what happens in politics because, you know, when I do a lot of speaking, obviously I do a lot of speaking with young people and tell them, you know, there's a group of folks that go up to Carson City every other year, and they're making decisions that impact all of us. You know, in that 6-month period, they're making decisions that impact all of us. And so for us to sit back and not be thinking about it, to not be engaged, to not think about, well, who is that person that I don't even know who my senator or my assembly person is, because I hear that all the time. And it's really disheartening as somebody who I take a lot of pride in what I do politically. And I know that we've had several politicians come to our door this cycle, and I ask them some tough questions. So why would I want to vote for you? What is it? Where do you stand on this? Where do you stand on that? And so when you hear that majority of our folks, and you know, despite that, yes, there's not a president being elected this time around, but we're making some pretty, you know, there's a lieutenant governor's race that is going to be very important. I don't think Governor Sandoval, a good man and all that, but there was no real legitimate challenger that stood. That wanted to go up against him, and so maybe that's a sign of the job he's doing. I don't know, but there's just a lot of question marks, and I for one don't get it why somebody would just be okay with, well, I don't really know who that person is, and they can go off and represent me and decide things for me, because it's going to impact you. It's going to impact you, whether it's in education, whether it's in the economy, whether it's in the type of jobs you might be doing in the future, not in the future. I mean, these are all decisions that are being made, and we need to be holding folks accountable, and we hold folks accountable by participating in the political process. So for me, I'm dumbfounded when majority of the folks have they're not paying attention to it. They're not staying engaged and involved.
Our number, 702-258-3552. That's 702-258-3552. And on the line is Lizette. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. What's on your mind this morning?
Well, I totally support and agree with the commentary about us each having a responsibility to do our part and influence others in any way we can, not only in our communities, but in the world. We I think as the United States, we do have influence in other countries, and we've pioneered a lot of different causes that countries weren't interested or even probably had awareness of in other areas. And I think this is very, very important for us to take accountability and to take charge and try to preserve our country for our children and our children's children. I think that's very, very important. And the other part of it is the jobs part is a concern, but I believe our economy is stronger than it's been probably since 2007. And therefore, I think it's a good time for us to make this step. Of course, in any situation, change brings fear. Change is never comfortable, but change is necessary. And it is our responsibility to create change in a positive way. I think that there was a report that I heard on your show or on your radio station about manufacturing coming back, and I believe it was the state of Missouri where manufacturing was basically dead, and in some of these states where manufacturing was the main industry. And now other industries have come in and created manufacturing jobs that are very well-paying jobs. You know, some of them are $20 an hour jobs that weren't there before. And of course, there's been a transition, and you know, there's been pain in the transition. But I think at this, now that we're on the other side of it, we're seeing success. And I think the same thing can happen here with the coal industry and the environmental companies that will probably pop up in this process.
And well, thank you very much, Lizette. Thanks for your comment. Number 702-258-3552, 702-258-3552. Let's go to Mike in Pahrump. Mike, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Oh, I got a lot on my mind. I have special needs children, and they were abused when we moved to Pahrump back in 2009 by the teacher. And by their special needs teacher, and they arrested the principal, the teacher, and the aides for abuse. And the DA out here, it really ties into the, you know, the primary elections and the whole system, and the, you know, special needs individuals who commit these, you know, mass shootings and stuff like that. Because one of my sons is already starting to ask me why this teacher never went to jail because she took a plea deal and still works for the school district.
And so when you say abuse, you mean physical abuse? They just got angry and hit the children?
No, she pretty much in the paper, from what we found out, we had to find stuff out from the press as it came out. But one of my sons, she actually took his hand and made him punch himself in the jaw until it was bruised.
Well, thanks very much, for the call, and I'm sorry for those problems. Thanks, Mike. The number 702-258-3552. That's 702-258-3552. Patrick, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Being a Las Vegan here and being an active voter, it bewilders me that government, whether it's evil or good, you know, has not made it more convenient in the 21st century for ladies and gentlemen constituents to really get out and vote. With all of the advances of social media and everything electronic that's available, we're really in the Stone Age, and people need a more convenient way to really register their vote and get it out there.
So, Sarah Felberg, should we be voting on the Internet?
I mean, obviously there are security issues with voting online or really doing anything online, and we've seen that in some of the big fraud cases recently involving, you know, high-end retailers like Target that have, you should have a very robust security network. But I think the caller makes a really good point. You know, we're requiring people to take time out of their days to go to certain locations. And in some cases, in different parts of the country, we're making voting even harder by voter ID laws and really making it difficult for people to get out and vote. If we want voter participation, let's do everything we can to reach people and to give them the opportunity to vote.
So, Jose, I mean, won't the Internet make it too easy if you can just click?
Well, I don't know. You know, the Internet, I wouldn't want to do anything like that over the Internet because it's too vulnerable right now. I think one way that you make voting easy and make it appealing for people to make it user-friendly is stop doing it during a weekday and make it on a Saturday. You know, there are countries that they will close. It's a national holiday so that folks can go and vote, can participate. And I've heard that argument before, right? Well, instead of doing it on a Tuesday, make it on a Saturday where more people are off work,
but,
so they can
I mean,
go.
Is it convenience or is it just apathy?
I don't know.
Well, Patrick, thanks very much for the call. The number 702-258-3552. Honey, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, I want to see primary debates on shows like yours. We, the citizenry, don't have radio shows. You do. So if you want more involvement, we need to know who our candidates are, and please do that.
Well, we have tried on some of these issues. I know, and some of the candidates won't come on.
Well, if they won't come on and debate each other, I guess they're going to lose out. Certainly some will.
So, Sarah, what about that?
And that's what I'd like to see, live debates, which are not simply responses to questions posed by a moderator.
So more debates would help get people more excited?
I think they do. You know, we saw, I think it was a primary debate. I can't remember where it was. Maybe Idaho, recently, that got some national attention because some of the candidates up there were fairly colorful and were making some really interesting statements during the debate. And I mean, that story went viral. That wasn't just interesting the people of Idaho. That was interesting people all over the country. I heard about it in Nevada. So I think, you know, getting people out and debating before primaries, you get to know the candidates better, and it'll hopefully raise interest.
Well, Nevada certainly has its share of eccentric candidates over the years. Maybe not this time, though. We've been talking about what's on your mind. Our guests have been Sarah Feldberg from the Las Vegas Weekly and Jose Melendres, who's Assistant Vice President for Diversity Affairs at UNLV. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Ian Milchrist, and thank you for listening to KNPR's State of Nevada.